And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting live from the UC Irvine campus. We stream live at kuci.org. And you can find this show and hundreds of others on iTunes at Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Today's Wednesday, November 6, 2019. And my guest is Walter Mosley. He's the author of more than 50 critically acclaimed books, including the major best-selling mystery series featuring E.Z. Rollins. His work has been translated into 25 languages and includes literary fiction, science fiction, political monographs, and a young adult novel. He's the winner of numerous awards, including the O. Henry, a Grammy, and Pen America's Lifetime Achievement Award. He's here today to primarily talk about his new book, The Elements of Fiction, published by Grove Press. And he was on a few years back with the book, This Year You Write Your Novel. Let's bring him on. Hi, Walter.
Hello.
Hi, great to have you on again.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love this book, and I would love to know how it came about.
Well, who knows? I had written This Year You Write Your Novel, which is, it's like an introduction to writing novels. It's like, if you want to write a novel, these are the things that you have to do, or probably the things you have to do. And I wrote it out. It was pretty simple. I thought that people could have a good introduction to novel writing. And that was fine. One of the things that I had written in that book was, trying to answer what is plot, versus story. And I said, well, plot is the structure of revelation. When you reveal what to the reader. And I liked that because it was both pedestrian and also, in a way, extraordinary. When all of a sudden you found out something about a main character, or you found out something about what was going on in that world, and you went, oh, my God. There was that moment. And so I decided to come back and write a much deeper dive into what it is to write fiction, and that way, original fiction. Because you can write fiction that's not original. It's just, it's that story again and again and again. But this one would be like, well, how does that change?
Yeah, and later, I see that line in the book, and then a little later you say plot isn't only the province of revelation. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, everything that you find out about everybody, like, for instance, if you're doing character development, when you find out something about a character which is, completely surprising to you, that is a reveal. It is a revelation, but it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with plot. It might be something that happened in their past. It might be some unconscious notion that they have. I wrote a book called John Woman recently, and about halfway through the book, I realized that John was a sociopath. He realized it at the same time. He went, oh my God, that's who I am. That's what I am. And so it's a revelation, but it's not, a plot-based revelation.
So yes, it sounds like you do not outline. Do you outline at all? I mean, how important is knowing where you're going? And is it a process of discovery? I mean, you've written so many novels, and so they're all successful. And so, I'm so curious how you do that.
Well, I think you shouldn't make the assumption that just because you've outlined a novel that you know where it's going. That you outline it, so that gives you a general idea of what direction you're going in. But anywhere along the way, you could change directions, really completely. It's the idea of an outline is just to give a collapsible structure that ultimately will help you get to the novel, but doesn't necessarily tell you what that novel is going to be.
Right. So in terms of the novel you mentioned, John Woman, you said, halfway through you discovered he's a sociopath. So does plot come out of character then for you?
Sometimes. it's funny. It's like every novel is different. Every way that you approach it is different. Every way that you write it is different. The wonderful thing about it is that it is, among, as many other things are, an art if you do it right. And in art, you discover it. I remember one of the things that Roy Lichtenstein, the wonderful painter, mm-hmm. Said to me, he said, the problem with most painters is they think they know what the painting is before they approach the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And, and really, Roy, he planned out everything. That doesn't mean it didn't change along the way.
Yeah, it seems that artists and other forms have an easier time of, I don't know if revising is the word, but playing with what they're doing and allowing it to evolve into what it means to be. Whereas in writing, we put down words and then we become married to them and we figure, I put a year into this. It has to be this. It can't be something else. It can't change.
Well, that's what people think. But I think a lot of painters think the same thing, and sculptors. There are a lot of people who, they're very rigid in their understanding of the representation of form. And if you are rigid in it, you're probably not going to have, you might have very entertaining, art or writing or whatever, music. But it's not going to be new music unless you allow it to change. If indeed it wants to. Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it says, no, we don't want to do that. We want to do this.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk about poetry, too, because you have a section in this book about poetry, and you say, I think it's at the end, you say, you need poetry in your life or your words will never sing with the divinity of the ordinary. I love that, and I also love that your writing is so much of it has a poetry to it, or a beat or a rhythm, and you can hear that in your mysteries. You can hear that in everything you write. Talk about that. Talk about needing poetry in your life, or your words will never sing.
Well, there are many things to say about poetry, but the big thing is poetry is like poetry goes to song, and song is the beginning of all writing for human beings. I mean, that goes all the way back, music and song. And when you're, so it being the oldest writing form, I think, poetry allows us to understand almost all the techniques of writing, condensation, repetition, assonance, rhyme, the idea of using one line to say many things. I mean, almost everything that's about writing is inside of poetry, and poetry also does the thing that people say about writing all the time is show don't tell. You don't tell me he loves her. Show me that he loves her. You don't tell me that he's angry. You show me that he's angry. Poetry knows how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry will never say he's angry because that doesn't mean anything. What's his how does his anger manifest itself? When two people say they're in love, great, but do they mean the same thing? Rarely. So how does that work? The idea poetry is really the heart of writing. If you don't understand poetry, your writing is going to be pretty dull.
Do you write it? Do you write poetry?
I do sometimes. I'm really bad at it.
I can't imagine that. I have a hard time believing that you would be bad at it, especially with the rest of...
Well, don't imagine it, but you can believe it. It's true.
But you've never published it, huh?
I've published a few poems
you have.
Over time. A long, long time ago, 30, 35 years ago, but, no.
In Elements of Fiction, you also talk about MFA programs. I kind of love what you say. You're not a big advocate, and you talk about how they are moneymakers, basically. I think it comes
right
down to that. Will you talk about that?
Well, it's just true. I mean, you have, it's not all places. Like, public schools are, much better, of course, but... Like, you have a lot of private schools, who have these big, they're very famous and they're very important, and so you're taking a class and the class costs you really thousands of dollars. Just a class costs you thousands of dollars. So the student is going deeply into debt. And, most writers don't make all that much money. So going deep into debt, it's not like you're trying to be a doctor or a lawyer, trying to be a writer who's not going to be making that much money. Also, the writers that they hire, they pay them a very small percentage of what they collect for those classes. And so that writer who's, you know, trying to, you know, keep, you know, literature alive in their heart finds more and more they're committed to this, you know, this educational bureaucracy. And I just try to get people to say, listen, you know, if you apply to a writer's program and you have enough money, they're going to accept you. They're never going to say to you, you know, I don't think a writer's program would be good for you. I think it would be better if you just, you know, move to Santa Anita and start going to the racetrack mm-hmm. every day. I think that would probably help you the best. No one's ever going to say that to you. And one has to think about it before they say yes. You know, because you end up, you know, owing $50,000, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, and that's just before, you know, the interest starts accruing. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I think, I imagine one reason writers love MFA programs or want to be in them is because it feels like a shortcut to publishing.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that's a conversation. You know, you need to have that, you know, most people who come out of programs, they might get published, you know, in the long run, but they're not going to get published so it's going to be worth, you know, $160,000.
Right.
You know, right. It's like, you know, you're writing and you're teaching. And because you have to do another job because you're so much in debt, then your writing suffers.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure does. But how did you learn to write?
I wrote a sentence, you know, one day, and I liked it very much. And I took a class from this guy in his apartment, and that was really cool. And then finally, there was a writing program at City College in New York, CCNY. And, you know, that's great. It costs $1,000 a year to go there. So you weren't dying. You know, you weren't like going deeply into debt. I was in that program until somebody bought a novel of mine, and then I left the program. And that's it.
Yeah, I did a little research, and I found that you went to Goddard. I went to Goddard as an undergraduate, and then you left there.
What years did you go?
I was there, I left there in 78.
Yeah, I left there, I think it's 72.
So, and then you went from there to Johnson?
Johnson State, yeah, in Vermont.
Yeah, I mean, what talk about all that. What did that do for you, or not?
You know, I love going to Goddard. They didn't really literally kick me out, but they suggested I leave.
What did you do?
So Goddard did that. Well, I just didn't do anything. I mean, their problem was is that, you know, I'd go hitchhiking around country and, you know, do all this stuff. And they were like, wait a second, you're supposed to be going to college. And I'm going, well, isn't this going to college? I'm having experiences. They go, no, it's not really. So I left there, but I stayed in Vermont. I love Vermont back in the early 70s. And finally, I decided to go to, you know, Johnson State College. It was one of the four or five state colleges they had at the time. And, you know, that was wonderful. I had a great time there. I graduated. I got a political science. And that was nice.
Yeah. I miss Vermont. I do miss Vermont somehow.
Well, a beautiful place.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Walter Mosley. We're talking primarily about the elements of fiction published by Grove. In Elements of Fiction, you say the act of writing a novel organizes the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think everybody should write a novel. There are many writers who, you know, who don't agree with me because they're afraid, you know, people are going to be competing with them. But, you know, the idea of putting a story together in your head, because any novel is larger than you could think about at one moment. You know, there's always, it's a really big thing. It goes over lots of, you know, experiences, thoughts, ideas, descriptions, characters, etc. But when you do it, when you write a novel, you're telling a story that you're committed to in whatever way, that helps you to kind of unconsciously to understand who you are in this world, you know, talking, doing, experiencing. And, you know, and I love that.
Yeah, yeah. And you have so very many books. I'm so curious whether And I imagine you're not a perfectionist so much as a completionist.
What does that mean?
Well, that, you know, I mean, writers can labor over a novel for 10 years to get it just right. And it does seem that if you, you know, kind of give yourself a time limit, whether it be, you know, a couple years, 5 years at most, something, you know, you may end up, you know, learning to write a novel, getting your work out there, and writing the next one, going on to the next one instead of having it.
Well, here's how I explain that to people. People ask me, they say, when do I know when my novel is finished? And I say, well, you write it, and then you read it, and you see problems, and you fix them. And then you read it again, and you see problems, and you fix them. And you do it again and again and again and again. You know, and finally, one day you read the novel, and you see problems, and you don't know how to fix them. Well, that's when your novel is finished.
Yeah, and hope that...
And those questions will be answered in the next novel. Because, you know, it's not just that you wrote one book, you're going to keep writing, you know, you know, short stories, maybe nonfiction, whatever, but you're going to move forward. And so the idea of perfection, you know, like, you know, Sister Carrie, written by Theodore Dreiser, you know, is one of America's great novels. It's really horribly written. It is. I mean, you look at it, you go, oh, my God, this is terrible. But I can't stop reading it because it's great, and it says something. You know, the idea that, you know, like, you know, a lot of writers think, well, I'm going to be perfect, and, you know, it's like you need to be in another field, because, you know, perfect is maybe mathematics. It certainly isn't, you know, fiction.
I guess part of that then these days is you can write quite an imperfect novel and put it out there yourself.
Yeah, you know, listen, people have always done that. That historically, that's a, you know, a big thing. If you're like a rich white man and, you know, 1740, you know, you write a book and you go to your father's friend who's a publisher, he's going to publish your book. I mean, it's a bad book. We don't remember them. They don't exist anymore. But, you know, that's always been the case. I'm not worried about, you know, what people do or how they do it or the technology of how they do it. You know, because, you know, the books, I know a lot of people who do, you know, street lit, you know, young black writers who write, you know, for, you know, people who basically are street people, not street people, but people who are, you know, they culturally, they're, you know, they're not, you know, going to, you know, libraries and bookstores and universities. And, you know, if those books are good books, people buy them. And if they're not good books, they don't buy them. They stop buying them, you know.
Yeah, I like that attitude. We have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about writing for TV. You work on the show Snowfall on Hulu. And
yeah.
How is that for you?
It's on FX, right?
On FX, yeah.
It's on Hulu, right? You can see the old shows on Hulu, but the new shows are on FX.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the crossover for you with writing novels, writing fiction, and writing for TV, working on TV?
You say crossover. What do you mean exactly?
I mean, you know, there's such different forms. You know, I mean, obviously, writing a novel, you're alone. Writing for TV, you're most likely in a writer's room, writing with others. But I mean, in terms of, you know, the chops, the skills, the techniques you use in writing fiction, what do you take from that when you're writing for TV?
Well, you know, everything you write is different, and that includes from one story to the next, or one novel to the next, or one poem to the next. I mean, you're always discovering new form in whatever you're doing. And when you change, you know, the medium, you know, let's say from like writing novels. I mean, the first thing is, yes, you're in a writer's room, which I hate, by the way. I hate being in a writer's room, even though something really good comes out of it. So I like it for that reason, but, you know, it's hard when, you know, somebody else wants to tell me what I'm thinking, you know, cause you know, I'm a novelist, I work alone, but it's the same thing. You need a plot, you need a story, you need a character, you need character development, you need a context. Let's say like in Snowfall, you know, the crack epidemic of the mid 80s. There's all kinds of different ways to go about it, you know, but in the end, it's writing, you know, like for instance, somebody says a dialogue, well, he's going to say something, she's going to say something. That's the same thing in a novel. What's different is that, you know, in a novel, you're in control of everything. And in a screenplay, you're in control of almost nothing. You know, you write it, you know, and you wrote all these nice words and everything, and you give it to the director, and the director says, you know, I don't think that's really working. Why don't you say this instead? Oh, well, you know, okay, fine, because that's how that works, you know.
So the writer's room, I would think one of the aspects of it that would be enjoyable as a novelist is being with others. You know, I mean, we're so alone so much of the time writing, and
that's not my experience.
Really?
You know? I used to be a computer programmer.
Uh-huh.
You were alone being a computer programmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely alone. So much alone. Like if you go out to a bar and you meet somebody, oh, hi, how are you? What you doing? What do you do? Okay, I'm a computer programmer. I was solving this problem today in assembler language. You know, it was a loop and a branch and loop register. You know, you watch people's eyes go, you know, go dark. I mean, when you start talking like that, you know, so you say I'm writing, you know, like let's say I'm writing for this show, the John Singleton show on FX and blah, blah, blah. They go, ooh, that sounds interesting. You know, so I'm not really sure that writing, you know, and also when I'm writing novels, I only write 3 hours a day. So I have a whole other day to go out and do things and meet people and see things, you know. And so that, you know, the weight is on me of whether or not I'm going to be dealing with people, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I agree with, I mean, a lot of people say it. A lot of people say, oh, it's a very lonely life, you know. And I have never felt that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk for 2 seconds about Devil in a Blue Dress with E.Z. Rollins. That was when that came out, I remember reading it and loving it. And it was mm-hmm. your first book. And it went on to become a series, which
a movie, not a series.
A movie. Okay. So, but yeah. Didn't E.Z. Reappear in other books?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The novel was. I think
right.
about the movie.
No,
I've done, I think, 15 E.Z. Rollins novels.
So the series, though, were not your idea, or did you love it when it was suggested? Why don't you bring them back?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of different things, you know, like that one might be interested in. I liked writing E.Z. The first book I wrote about E.Z. was not a mystery. It's called Gone Fishing. And, you know, that I couldn't even get that published. And then, until later. And then, you know, then I wrote Devil in a Blue Dress. And I went to my publisher. My publisher said, this is great. And so we're going to buy this book. But we'll only buy it if you let us buy another one, too. So you're promising us that you're going to write at least 2 of these books. And I went, wow, that's great. I can make money. I don't have to be a computer programmer. That's really cool. Let's do it. You know, so it was fun. And, you know, I'm enjoying E.Z. because I'm writing the book because I want to write about the black history of Los Angeles in the middle of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm doing. And it's a lot of fun, you know? So until I come across a time where it's no longer interesting to me, I'm going to do that along with all the other writing I do.
Hmm. What about secondary characters? How important are they? And what part should they play in a novel?
Well, I mean, everything in a novel is important. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, certainly, to answer your question, secondary characters are you know, really important. Like, for instance, if you only have one character in a book, it's really hard to figure out who they are, what they're thinking, where they're going. You know, so they need people to, you know, talk to bounce off of, to react to, who, you know, who love them, who hate them, who are after them, who are running away from them, whatever it is. You need that. And so, you know, and those are what you would call secondary characters all through the book. So, I mean, everything that you write about has as much importance as anything else you write about.
Hmm.
If all of a sudden you say, well, I can just skip over explaining what this room looks like, you know, you stop and say, no, you can't do that. You got to say what the room, if there's a room and the look is important, you got to do that. You know, and, you know, I think a lot of writers have that problem. They think, well, the important thing is what my main character is thinking. And yeah, it is, except for everything around it is what brings that out.
Hmm. Do you read your work aloud? Because I'm thinking that beat either has to be so fixed in your brain, or you're reading it aloud to make sure the sentences
have rhythm.
Well, I
always read things out loud. And in the beginning, and still every once in a while, I read it into a tape recorder.
Hmm.
So I can, that's reading out loud, and then I can hear it also.
And then what do you do? I mean, are you listening for those, are you listening for the rhythm? What are you listening for?
Well, I don't know. I just listen. I mean, and if I hear something wrong, mm-hmm. I fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't, that's good.
And then earlier you said, in terms of revising, you read it, you go over it, you change it, you read it, you go. Do you give yourself a time frame? I mean, do you go, I'm only going to give this much time?
And No. I would like to say that, but truth is, it's like if I read through, I might read through the book and say, this is the last time I'm doing this. I do that often. But then when I get to the end, I say, I really got to do it again because, there's all these things I haven't really dealt with. And so I do it again.
Hmm. As I was reading The Elements of Fiction, I was wondering how short stories or short fiction fits into this. I mean, how this could apply. Can it apply?
I don't understand, actually, the question.
Well, that the book seems to be mostly concerning the novel. And so just applying this book to writing short stories.
I think this book can apply to anything you're writing, including love letters. I mean, it's like, it's mostly the novel, so 99% of it will fit with the novel you're writing. But, 84% will fit with the short story you're writing. I mean, there are differences about short stories, but which is probably too long to go into now. But there are differences there, but not so much that you can't, gain something about, how did dialogue work? How does character development work? How those things. They're all the same in almost anything you write, a play, a screenplay, a novel, a short story, even in poetry at times, especially old-time poetry.
Hmm. I know you have to go, and before we end, I wonder if you just have a few last words for the writers listening.
Well, the idea about writing, I think, for me, which I think is the most important thing. Sometimes I run across a person and I'll say, so what do you do? And they go, well, I'm a writer. And they go, oh, wow, great. So what are you working on? And they go, well, nothing right now. I finished the book, a few years ago and published it. And, and now I'm just, not doing that. And I go, so really, I don't say this, but I think it. So you used to be a writer. And one day you may be a writer again, but right now you're not a writer. And
mm-hmm.
And I think that it's really important. I think that writing is a calling, and then so if you're going to define yourself as a writer, then you're going to have to be a writer.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I don't get that, or they think about writing in a very kind of like special way, like I'm a writer, It's like, but you look at somebody like Balzac with his 180 novels, or Zola with his 124 novels, or Dickens or Twain. People who are, they're working because it's not just one book; it's a whole lifetime of books, and that's where that stuff comes from. So, I mean, if you want to write a book, you write a book. And somebody says, well, what do you do? I said, well, right now, I'm a, I work in a zoo, but last year I published a novel. I said, okay, that sounds good. What's it like working in a zoo?
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for being with us for this half hour. And
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. That was Walter Mosley. His book that we were talking about was The Elements of Fiction. Published by Grove, and I thought he could be here the whole time. He could not. He thought we were on the East Coast. He's on the West Coast, but we're on the West Coast, and so I hope you enjoyed that half hour, and you've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're online. This will be podcast in the next few days on iTunes and Stitcher, so we'd be much appreciative if you went to iTunes and subscribed. And if you like the show, leave us a little review. so it will help others find it. I'm going to put on some music, see if I have a past show that I can play for you. And in the meantime, listen to the music, get out your notebook, and get some writing done.
Presiento que este mundo y este tiempo necesita humanidad, que habita en las luces de los sueños, del amor y la verdad. Presiento que hoy llega el viento para avisar en una canción de amor. Presiento que da vueltas el planeta yendo a donde nunca fue, cambiando los versículos del cuento de lo astuto y de la fe. Presiento no ha sido cierto ir a buscar toda la razón al sol. Volvamos a empezar a respirar las flores, dejándonos llevar por risas y colores. Volvamos a inventar un mundo de ilusiones y una sola voz de corazones. Presiento que se oculta este momento de la estricta realidad, le hacen ronda al pensamiento, pero nadie empuja más. Me entrego en aquel concepto de ir a brindar mi definición, definición de amor.
Alex Cuba with the CD Sublime. Really nice. I pulled it off the new shelf. And you're still listening to Writers and Writing. This is Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And what I found that I'm going to put on for you for the rest of the time up until 10 a.m. Pacific time is Howard Zinn. I found a spoken word CD that's called Artists in a Time of War. And that's what I will play. So hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you back here next week.
About this topic, I won't say I've never talked, but I've never talked about this topic, you know, the art and society. Of course, I've thought about it. My wife is a painter. I have artist friends. Some of my best friends are artists. Some of them are here, observing me. But as I say, yeah, I've thought about it, of course, all of us have. And what comes to mind when I think of the, you know, the relationship of the artist to society, what should be the relationship of the artist to society. And with me, it's always a question of what should be and not what is. But I think of the word transcendent, which is a word I've never used in public. But it was the only thing I could come up with to describe what I think about the role of the artist. And by that I mean, you know, not, you know, Immanuel Kant's, well, yes, sort of close to it, but not really his idea of what is transcendent, something like it. But the idea is that the artist transcends the immediate, transcends the here and now. The artist, well, transcends the madness of the world, transcends the madness of terrorism, transcends the madness of war. And the artist thinks outside the framework and acts and paints and does music and writes outside the framework that society has created. And the artist may do no more than, and I don't mean to minimize it by saying no more than, the artist may do more than, you know, give us beauty and laughter, passion, surprise, drama, and that's good. That is, the artist needn't apologize for just doing that, because in doing that, the artist is telling us what the world should be like, even if it isn't that way now. And the artist is taking us away from the moments of horror that we experience every day in this world, some days more than others, and showing us something else, showing us what is possible. There's no need for an artist to apologize about just giving us something that is passionate and beautiful and funny or any of those. No need to apologize for that. Yeah. But there is more. As the artist can do more, yes, should do more. Not only that, but more. Because the artist is also a citizen, the artist is a human being. I mean, I face that in a different way, in that if I can be classified, well, yeah, the society classifies me. Say, I'm a historian. That scares me. To be classified, I'm a historian, you see. But I don't want to be just a historian. But the society disciplines us. It puts us into a discipline. You're a historian. You're a businessman. You're an engineer. You're a this. You're a that. And the first thing somebody asks you at a cocktail party is, what do you do? Which means, you know, what is your profession? What is your, you know, how are you categorized? And the problem is that people begin to think that that's what they are, and that's all they are, that they're professionals in something. And you hear the word professionalism being used, and people say, you've got to be professional. Whenever I hear the word, I get a little scared, because that limits human beings to working within the limits set by this, you know, profession. As a historian, I would face this, and there would be, during the Vietnam War, there would be meetings of historians Can you imagine what a wonderful feeling that is, to be among 2,000 historians at a meeting? And I remember during the Vietnam War, this question was, at one of our great meetings of historians, the war was raging in Southeast Asia, and the question was, should historians take a stand on the war? And it was a big debate on this. Really, there's a big debate on this. And some of us, you know, introduced a resolution saying, you know, we historians think the United States should get out of Vietnam. A simple little thing. And then there were others who said, no, it's not that we don't think the United States should stay in Vietnam. It's not that at all. It's just that we're historians. It's not our business. Hey, whose business is it? So the historian says it's not my business, and the businessman says it's not my business, and the lawyer says it's not my business, and you know, the artist says it's not my business, and whose business is it? You mean we're going to leave the business of the most important issues in the world to the people who run the country? I mean, how stupid can you be? I mean, haven't we had enough experience historically with leaving the important decisions to the people in the White House, or the people in Congress, or the people in the Supreme Court, or the people who dominate the economy? We've had lots of experience leaving the important decisions to them, because the citizen doesn't know he's a citizen. He thinks he's only a doctor or a lawyer or a historian or an artist or whatever. But back in the 18th century, Rousseau said, you know, I see all sorts of people who are doing this and doing that and doing this and doing that, but where are the citizens among us? You know, everybody must be involved. There are no experts. Well, there are. I remember during the Vietnam War, I keep going back because that's, you know, there are certain historical moments when learning is more intense than at any other period. I mean, this is one of those moments too, right now, after September 11th. But Vietnam was one of those moments when learning is compressed into a short span of time and place. And one of the things we learned about during those years was about experts, and about when the war started and people would ask questions, why are we there? I said, well, listen to the experts. The experts would get on television and tell us why we're there. And I remember the British actor, an artist, right? Actors are artists. The British actor, Peter Ustinov, spoke out against the war in Vietnam. And then somebody said, Ustinov, he's an actor. He's not an expert. And Ustinov replied, there are experts in little things, but there are no experts in big things. There are experts in this fact and that fact and that fact, but there are no moral experts. It's important to remember that all of us, whatever we do, have the right to make moral decisions about the world, and undeterred by the cries that will come up, oh, you don't know, you're not an expert. These people up there, they know. Well, it takes only a little bit of history to realize how dangerous it is to think that the people who run the country know what they're doing. So the word transcendent comes to mind when I think of the role of the artist in dealing with the issues of the day. And I use the word transcendent to suggest that the role of the artist is to transcend the given wisdom, to transcend the word of the establishment, to transcend the orthodoxy, to transcend, to go beyond, to escape what is handed down by the government or what is said in the press or what is said on television. Because there are people in the arts and people in other professions who think, yes, let's get involved, but let's get involved in the way we are told to be involved. And then you will see the artists and the other people in professions getting in line in the way that people are expected to get in line when the president says, this is what we must do, and everybody else in politics echoes that, and this is what we must do. And we've seen this all around now. I mean, how many times have I read in the press since September 11th, well, we must be united. Now, what do they mean by that? I would like us to be united, but united around what? And when people say we must be united, most of the time when they say this, they are saying either explicitly or implicitly, we must be united around whatever the president tells us to do. Dan Rather, right? TV anchor, anchored to the establishment. Right. Isn't that what an anchor man is? And Dan Rather gets up on national television and says, Bush is my president. When he says get in line, I get in line. Did any of you read that? Yes, he said it. I mean, I make up some things. But I didn't make that up, you see. And I thought, here is a very important, influential journalist. And he has forgotten the first rule of journalism, which is think for yourself. He's forgotten what that great journalist, I.F. Stone, one of the several greatest journalists of the 20th century, what I.F. Stone used to say when, you know, he stopped working for the major media. He was working for regular newspapers, and then he realized he couldn't be himself. He couldn't say what he wanted to do. And so he established his own little newsletter, I.F. Stone's Weekly, which became famous for giving you things that you couldn't get anywhere else. And then I.F. Stone would be invited to speak to classes of journalism students. And he would say, I'm going to tell you a number of things, but you really only have to remember if you really want to be a good journalist. You really only have to remember two words. Governments lie. Very important to remember. Governments lie. I mean, not just the American government. Governments in general lie. And when I say all governments lie, that may sound like an anarchist statement. The anarchists have something there. Yeah. They're right to be skeptical and suspicious of people who hold governmental power, because the tendency of people who hold governmental power is to lie in order to maintain that power. And Rather, when he said that, the president says, get in line, I get in line, he violated that, you know, Hippocratic oath of journalists that is implied in the profession of journalism of think for yourself. The kind of statement you would expect from a journalist in a totalitarian state, not somebody living in a democracy. And then, talking about getting in line, and then you have Al Gore, who accepted his defeat graciously, so graciously that he became humble, overwhelmingly humble, so that when all of this happened, Gore announced, Bush is my commander-in-chief. I thought, I don't think he's read the Constitution. The Constitution says that the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He's not the commander-in-chief of the country, of all of us, you see. But here are all these people rushing to get in line, rushing to get inside the perimeter, you know, of power. You know. And it's the job of the artist to transcend that, to think outside the boundaries, to dare to say things that no one else will say. And fortunately, we've had, all through history, artists who dared to do that. Well, I think of Mark Twain, and here he was writing these great novels which everybody loved. The story is a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. But when the United States went to war in 1898 against Spain, and then after a quick defeat of Spain, what was called a splendid little war, the United States went to war in the Philippines. That was not a splendid little war. That was a long and ugly war to subdue the Filipinos who wanted to run the Philippines themselves. A war which in its atrocities foretold the war in Vietnam. Yeah. And Mark Twain became one of the voices speaking out against that war. And when Theodore Roosevelt in 1906, and by then the war had been going on for 5 years, and there were several hundred thousand Filipinos dead. Well, you will not find much in your history books about how many Filipinos died in that war. But in 1906, the U.S. Army committed a massacre in the Philippines. You might call it an act of terrorism. That is, in the sense that innocent people were simply mowed down by an army unit. And Theodore Roosevelt sent a message of congratulations to the general who carried out the operation against these Moros, these Muslims in the southern Philippines, who were virtually unarmed, who didn't know anything about modern warfare, men, women, children, just all mowed down, every single one of them. And after Roosevelt congratulated the general for this great military victory, Mark Twain denounced Roosevelt for this and became one of the leading protesters against the war in the Philippines. He stepped out of his role as just a storyteller whom everybody loved and got into the fray and dared to say things that so many people in the country were not saying. And of course, people then questioned his patriotism.
That was Howard Zinn, Artists in a Time of War, a spoken word CD right here at KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We'll see you next week. Have a good week writing, and remember to stay in the chair.